paper 35, right at the beginning, which is old single column, page 384. And this is the beginning of the next block of papers. So we had the first block in part two here, those first three papers, just on local universes in general. And now you have six papers on the beings in local universes. So the universes of beings. they start out, as you see, with the rest of the story that they promised us way back when we were reading about the Paradise Sons. You may remember at the beginning of that paper, they couch those Paradise Sons in the context of all of the descending suns. And so you have the Paradise ones and then the local universe ones below. And they said, we'll talk about the local universe ones later. Well, later has finally arrived. So I think that's all the preface we need. Let's just jump in and see what they have to say about the local universe suns here.
Paper 35, The Local Universe Sons of God. The sons of God previously introduced have had a paradise origin. They are the offspring of the divine rulers of the universal domains. Of the first paradise order of sonship, the creator sons, there is in Nebadon only one, Michael, the universe father and sovereign. Of the second order of paradise sonship, the Avenal or magisterial sons, Nebadon has its full quota, 1,062. And these lesser Christs are just as effective and all-powerful in their planetary bestowals as was the creator and master son on Urantia. The third order, being of Trinity origin, do not register in a local universe, but I estimate there are in Nebadon between 15 and 20,000 Trinity teacher sons, exclusive of 9,642 creature trinitized assistants of record. These paradise Danels are neither magistrates nor administrators. They are super teachers.
Okay, so you can see sort of the parallel. They have a little preface about the Paradise Sons to begin with. You know, and you have fun little tidbits, creating a so-called lesser Christ's idea there. And they're lesser, as they're pointing out very definitively there, only in the sense that they're not personalized deity. And those magisterial sons, the Avonal sons, are not God. They're just creatures, very high divine creatures. So it's only lesser in that sense. In terms of the quality of a bestowal or anything like that, like they're strongly emphasizing there, there's nothing lesser about them. You get the spirit of truth, afterwards and everything. Now, yes, there is a distinction between a creator son doing his bestowal and what happens with the spirit of truth after that. There is an upgrade, sort of the spirit of truth that's been poured out on all the worlds prior to that by a magisterial son. Even in that regard, those people's didn't want for anything because of that. Everything is happening just as it's supposed to unfold in the evolutionary process. You don't want to think of things in an existential way where, someone is being deprived relative to infinity and eternity, and that's the only thought, you have. It's all as it should unfold. It's very important. It's indispensable to the completion of the Supreme to have worlds that have a long time, with a spirit of truth that is prior to the Creator Son doing his bestowal mission. You couldn't make the Supreme Being without those worlds. Every element, quote unquote, high or low, is equally important to the total. You know, and so every differential has its place and its significance and its irreplaceable quality. Okay. Now, so besides, you know, the rest of it's pretty straightforward, except for one tantalizing little curious thing they throw in there. Very startling statement that leads you on a journey to try to figure out what's going on. You know, when they say of the second order of paradise sonship, you know, right in the middle of the paragraph there, the Avonal or Magisterial Sons, Nebadon has its full quota. You know, so giving you a full quota number, which is intriguing. But then you read the number. 1,062, that's it? 1,062? Yeah. You know, okay, you know, remember what's going on here. Remember back when we read about the Magisterial Sons. You have three different types of missions that they go on. There's the judicial missions, where, you know, they're in charge of ending a dispensation on a world. Okay, you've got, you know, pushing towards, you know, when all is said and done, 10 million inhabited worlds in a local universe. Now, okay, yes, they're not all coming online simultaneously. They're spread out over time, so you don't need to minister to all 10 million simultaneously or anything like that, you know, but still, you know, once things are up and rolling, there's a, you know, there's going to be a lot of worlds in play, millions of worlds. And, you know, every time you get into a dispensation, there's been, you know, there's a dispensational adjudication that they need to oversee. Then you've got magisterial missions that they go on, you know, and there's at least the one, you know, that's normally prior to the bestowal son, you know, and they mention on a lot of worlds there may be multiple ones before the bestowal son and multiple ones after the bestowal son.
Okay. Those are, what, 10,000 years?
Well, yeah, well, I mean, those ages, but, you know, exactly how long a son stays, you know, is not really described.
Well, yeah. Doesn't an Avonal only do one bestowal mission?
Now we're going to get to that in just a second. You're jumping the gun.
It never does make sense to me.
Okay, so, you know, so you've got all of those, you know, magisterial mission jobs that have to be taken care of. And then, of course, you know, for every world in the local system except for one, they've got to do the bestowal son mission. Okay. Okay, so you're going, wow, I mean, that, you know, a little over 1,000 seems pretty scant for all of those duties. Okay, and then on top of that, let me just, I'm flipping back to, this is paper 20, section 2. Paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Page
225 in the old single column. So let me remind you of what we read back there. It just adds to this mystery here. You know, they gave you a quick little introduction to the judicial actions, the magisterial missions, and the bestowal missions. And then they say, there is no limit to the number of times the Avonal sons may serve on magisterial and on bestowal missions. Okay, well, so far it's like, it's a good thing it says that, because, yeah, it's sounding like they're going to have to do a lot of rounds. But usually, when the experience has been 7 times traversed, you know, and they seem to be lumping magisterial and bestowal together there, there is suspension in favor of those who have had less of such service. These sons, you know, these sort of, you know, well-experienced sons on these missions, these sons of multiple bestowal experience, okay, now they've qualified, so it seems like, okay, they've got multiple bestowal experience, are then assigned to the high personal council of a creator's son, thus becoming participants in the administration of universe affairs. Which sounds like they're taken out of action. So how do you, you know, see, they've, and, you know, they've just left this dangling, right? So you're left thinking about this, like, okay, so it really does seem like They're suggesting that there is a, they come into service and they serve mightily for a span of time and then sort of graduate to some upper class group sort of or whatever. But then what? Well, I mean, your first thought is, you know, the fact that they say that you have a full quota of, you know, these sons that are serving as magisterial sons, they must be restocked.
They must what?
They must be restocked from paradise, from the reserves off of paradise. They must, so they must have a constant number of 1,062 to handle the you know, the primary duties. And when they graduate out, you know, they bring in new ones. I mean, otherwise, you know, okay, this just doesn't add up. So I think between the lines, see, that's what we've got a suggestion of, that you've got an ever-refreshing supply. Now, this issue of what becomes of these well-experienced bestowal sons, well, and magisterial too, because remember, at the very least, when a magisterial son serves on a magisterial mission, the first magisterial mission on a world, always that first one on a world, you know, there may only be one, but, you know, always that first one, they serve incarnated, not incarnated as babe, but incarnated as adult. They are incarnated. Okay, if they're incarnated, they have an adjuster. Okay, and they have a soul. And that soul subsequently fuses with them. All right, so think about this. There, you know, I think I probably mentioned that way back when paper 20, when we were reading it. You know, so you've got these long experienced magisterial sons who have incorporated many souls into their being, multiple, you know, Marantia selves have been absorbed into their nature. You know, they're a radically transformed group of beings relative to what left paradise. You know, they don't even remotely resemble what left paradise anymore. You know, that, you know, they've been brought very definitively down, you know, amongst beings that are like the mortals, you know, and ascending, you know, with a, you know, relative to a Marantia soul. You know, not to mention, of course, the Creator Son now has, you know, his soul, Jesus's, you know, Marantia self, copy of Jesus's higher self. You know, fused with Michael, and, you know, he's still Jesus because of that. You know, so he's like that too. As we go through these papers on the beings and local universes, that'll come back around again eventually. Just keep in mind that that's a curious little outstanding issue. What becomes of these, you know, when you read thus becoming participants in the administration of universe affairs, you know, it all sounds, you know, okay, whatever. No, think about it. You know, especially now that he's a master son, they would be administering with him, you know, on a par with him to a degree. It's not, you know, creature creator unifying. Okay, you don't have, you know, they weren't creators, but they have all of that mortal experiential nature just like he does and can very appropriately serve as his assistants. Okay. Yeah. You know, but it is, you know, kind of fascinating to think about, you know, maybe he did it 50 times. You know, he was a mortal, you know, effectively and had a soul established and, well, yeah, it has, you know, but it's usually, you know, there's bound to be an individual way out on the bell curve, you know, that could have a whole bunch.
They experienced many visitations both before and after.
but they may be visited many times by the same phenomenon.
Yeah, and with the magisterial missions, you know, they can, if they choose, they can be incarnated multiple times on those as well.
He even says sometimes they'll come back incarnated either.
Right, yeah. I mean, they don't always come back. But just, you know, we're just really kind of focusing on the amazing thing, the incarnated thing, because that involves an adjuster and a soul. And so it's just a, you know, there just isn't any place where they say, you know, you're probably wondering about this whole soul thing. Let it, you know, they just leave that dangling, you know, for you to wonder about how does that work and what's that like. I mean, you know, Michael is not dissimilar. I mean, he only had, you know, one mortal, you know, bestowal where he had literally had an adjuster and a soul, but those six other, you know, bestowals and were literal, you know, he acquired that being's nature and absorbed it into his prior being, you know, so he has sort of multiple, you know, selves that have become one self also. Fused into oneself. All right, so just I wanted to stress that because this is the point that just really gets you thinking about that when they really throw that number out and you know and you're going, well, geez, did they drop three zeros or something? You know, or what? But if you think about it, you know, they kind of set it up so that you wouldn't assume that maybe it's a typo. You know, there's one Creator Son. You know, they're trying to remind you. You're talking about paradise beings, so that you know you're not going to need lots of them to handle a local universe in terms of quality. Let's say, I guess. But then it gets you thinking about the quantity aspect and this whole numbers issue, and you know, and then you start wondering. It's like you know, could you maybe do some rough calculations if you worked on it and try to figure out how many worlds in a local universe might possibly be needing them at any given time, you know? Because obviously once you get through the early, you know, stages, you know, you're not going to be needing them anymore. You know, you get to the Trinity, Teacher, Sons, and Beyond, and Light and Life, you know, and they're settled way deep in Light and Life and all this stuff, you know? So you have a whole bunch of worlds in the local universe, that, you know, that are sort of, you know, beyond that. But anyway.
Well, they say here we have reason to believe in the total number of Master Sons in the Grand Universe mm-hmm. is about 1 billion. So if there's a total of 1 billion in the whole Grand Universe, and you know, you divide that by 7, and then mm-hmm. divide by, you know, mm-hmm. it's not too far off from this particular number of 1,000. So.
Yeah, I know. See, there's this, it's a very interesting.
They must do a lot of work.
But see, that, like I said, see, that just, you know, that gives you senses of sort of where you are developmentally and stuff, you know, you've got the reserves, you know, back in the central universe. You know, but how many are actually out here and how many are sort of really, you know, in their initial roles, how many have moved on to this mysterious sort of second stage and
where'd you find that, John?
Paper 20.
Yeah. Yeah, back up in paper 20 there.
So
yeah.
Can you tell us again how many worlds are in Nebadon, in the habited worlds?
Well, I mean, you're moving towards 10 million.
10 million. Okay.
Right, because you got, remember, you have 100 constellations, and in each constellation you have 100 local systems, so that's 100 times 100. Now, and then you have roughly 1,000 inhabited worlds in each local system. Okay, so you go from 10,000 to 10 million, you multiply by that roughly 1,000.
But in the grand universe, trillion.
Right.
So you divide that by a billion, and that's not even 1,000.
Right.
7,000.
But see, again, see, you know, and that's where you start, you know, see, there's all these little data points they give you and that you could work with and try to pin down, like, how many worlds in the grand universe actually, you know, are in need of magisterial sons, how of them are, you know, I mean, you got local universes that are settled in light and light, you know, and stuff. So, you know, they're way beyond needing, you know, these sorts of things, you know, in general. Incarnated missions anyway, yeah. There's all these data points that you can piece together if you really wanted to, you know, try to pin some of this down. And you probably could kind of deduce some things about, you know, how far along things are in various ways in terms of evolution and stuff. Advanced readers, you know, will get into those things, I'm sure, somewhere, you know, centuries ahead. Okay. All right. So, you know, so enough said about the paradise suns. Now they're going to move into the main topic at hand.
The types of suns about to be considered are of local universe origin. They are the offspring of a paradise creator sun in varied association with the complemental universe mother spirit. The following orders of local universe sonship find mention in these narratives. 1. Melchizedek sons. 2. Verondadek sons. 3. Lenonandek sons. 4. Life carrier sons.
Okay, so just a couple little things that they slip in there. So you notice they're pointing out that a creator son and creator mother spirit, when they come together to make a being, they have all kinds of knobs, internal knobs that they can in turn and adjust, you know, adjust how they overlap, you know, or whatever you want to think in terms of, you know, what aspects of each of them come into liaison and produce a being. And so to give you these different variations, and then you notice the other thing they slipped in there, and they, you know, don't forget there's some other suns that we aren't revealing to you, because they don't have immediately to do with the ascension scheme, right? We keep reminding ourselves of that little wild card that's, you know, threading along here. We saw that back in paper 30 when we went to the list, remember, about the suns that they don't reveal. But, you know, in each case, they've got, you know, they're modifying. And so, you know, I mean, the first thing you can think about is with a creator son, you have both son-type deity and father-type deity together as one there. So there's a differential, and, you know, that, you know, you can obviously adjust that and, you know, countless other things we can't even imagine. Not to mention there's this whole issue of how you know, the deity of the sevenfold comes into this, which is very mysterious. But you know, just right up front, you can see the father-son differential as being something he could vary. And with the creative mother spirit, there's spirit mother. You know, there's mother-type deity and there's spirit-type deity together as one, spirit mother. You know, and so there's a potential for variation there with her, you know, and all the different combinations. That one can vary it all different ways, and one can keep one, you know, their dial fixed, and, you know, and all, you know, right. So there's all these different possibilities of how they conjointly express themselves. Okay, and we'll see that's immediately comes in play when you start thinking about Father Melchizedek. That's why they put this in, and I'm belaboring it a little bit to get you to set that up. They want you to be, you know, thinking about that when you become a more advanced student. All right, so let's get some more here.
Triune paradise deity functions for the creation of three orders of sonship: the Michaels, the Avonals, and the Danals. Dual deity in the local universe, the sun and the spirit, also functions in the creation of three high orders of sons: the Melchizedeks, the Verondadeks, and the Lenonandeks. And having achieved this threefold expression, they collaborate with the next level of God the Sevenfold in the production of the versatile order of life carriers. These beings are classified with the descending sons of God, but they are a unique and original form of universe life. Their consideration will occupy the whole of the next paper.
Okay, yeah. Like I said at the end there, we'll get into the details when we get to paper 36. But if you don't remember off the top of your head what they're referring to there about the next level of God the Sevenfold, a life carrier son has a third parent. There's three parents. One of the Ancients of Days participates in that creative act. And we'll, you know, we can get into talking about that a little bit, about why. But you know, you may remember an Ancient of Days is a Trinity origin being. And that's sort of the wild card that's always going to be in play. You think about beings in their relationship to the seven absolutes of infinity, say, you know, one of the seven absolutes is not the Paradise Trinity. And you don't want to ever forget that there's that other fact that is very much universally functioning and in play and has all kinds of things to do with adding its functioning to the mix. So a Creator Son and Creator Mother Spirit can turn their dials and adjust their liaison, but then the Paradise Trinity can enter in and modify on top of that. And there's an obvious avenue for that entry with the Creative Mother Spirit, right? Because what kind of deity does she have? Mother-type deity, which stems from the Paradise Trinity. See, so that's an obvious avenue in for the Paradise Trinity to engage, sort of directly as the Paradise Trinity rather than, quasi down through Mother deity, okay, combined with other facts. Okay, but they do mention, in terms of these revealed sons, it does appear the way they say this, you've got definitively the top three, and from what they tell us about the structure of how local universes work, it doesn't seem like we're missing some real leader, ruler sort of son. We've got someone for the local system, someone for the constellations, and someone to handle all around Salvington, all around the local universe capital with the Melchizedek University that we'll be reading about in a little bit here, and all the other things that Melchizedek's do, sort of a wild card, doing emergency things and whatnot to fill in the gaps, So most likely these other sons are not is doing that sort of really sort of foundational element in the picture, but is involved in kind of like the life carrier sons and the material sons and daughters are in more of the details of what goes on in the framework that's set up and administered. Spirits, you've got the framework, but what happens within the framework, that's apparently where the unrevealed elements lie. Okay. Let's see. All right. Yep. So let's get to the first group. They're going to do the Melchizedek's first. And we've got this. They're not they're not like the Varonodex and the Lenonodex, where you just have the Varonodex and the Lenonodex. You have the Melchizedek and a special Melchizedek, who's really, not quite the same as any of the others. So first of all, let's get to him.
One, the Father Melchizedek. After bringing into existence the beings of personal aid, such as the bright and morning star and other administrative personalities, in accordance with the divine purpose and creative plans of a given universe, there occurs a new form of creative union between the Creator Son and the Creative Spirit, the local universe daughter of the Infinite Spirit. The personality offspring resulting from this creative partnership is the original Melchizedek, the Father Melchizedek, that unique being who subsequently collaborates with the Creator Son and the Creative Spirit to bring into existence the entire group of that name.
Okay, so just touch on that last thing first. Notice, so there's a similarity with the life carrier sons, with the Melchizedeks, that you don't have a creator, but you have a procreator, you would say, participating in the process of bringing the other Melchizedeks into existence. So that's kind of an interesting thing to imagine, that in the midst of a creator liaison, a creature can enter that space and somehow you know, not be modified by that or something, you know, that actually has the integrity to sort of put themselves into a creative energy space, you know, and stand integrous in it. So that's telling you something interesting about how a Father Melchizedek is made, that they, you know, they can withstand some serious external, you know, influence and stay integrous. You know, you're kind of reminded of, you know, when you go to the Isle of Paradise and they tell you, now there's no structures in this area, and we talked about that, because, you know, if you put something there, it just, you know, immediately disappear because it can't withstand, you know, the disassembling energy of that. You know, so here you kind of have this similar thing there. You got to think of this very literally. There's going to be some sort of a space that is going to be filled with a very dynamic energy, you know, that would reorganize all of our molecules if we got in there. But he can somehow go into that space and participate in it. It's kind of interesting. Yep.
So that foot that says between the Creator Son and the Creator Spirit, then it says, comma, the local universe, daughter of the infinite spirit. So that's the Creative Spirit is the local.
I was just about to get to that. That was the next thing I was going to say. So as you go back there, you see they're talking about. So, actually, before we get to that, just notice what they say before that. They say, okay, you bring in, you know, in our case, Gabriel. You bring the bright morning star into existence, and notice they reminded you again. There's a whole bunch of beings they don't reveal, that are related to Gabriel. So there's a creative process where things are in a certain mode, where Gabriel and some similar beings are created by the Creator, Son, and Creator, Mother, Spirit. And then, like they say, they adjust their dials and go into a different liaison mode. And they gave you a little hint, okay? They purposely threw in that parenthetical of reminding you that, you know, the Creative Spirit is the local universe daughter of the infinite spirit. You know, remember when we start thinking about a creative spirit, you have this downstepped expression of the infinite spirit as a creative spirit, and it downstepping into another it, a localized it, you know, just the creative spirit. Okay, its are not daughters, right? What are they reminding you between the lines? That it's actually the creative mother spirit, and you know, when you're creating other beings in the local universe, you don't have just a creative spirit, you have a creative mother spirit. There's mother deity. So you remember, you know, they weren't allowed to put that stuff, you know, that's, we're putting all that in because we figured that out, like they wanted us to figure out, and now we can see between the lines. Why did they put that in there? Because they're trying to remind you that fundamentally, you need mother deity to understand what they're about to do. Okay? So we'll get into that in a minute. So, you know, just there's a hint there that the Melchizedek, and especially the Father Melchizedek to begin with here, is different than Gabriel in the sense that there is more of the mother fact of the creative mother spirit going into that son. All right, so then let's get a little bit more, and you'll see they keep teasing this out.
In the universe of Nebadon, the Father Melchizedek acts as the first executive associate of the Bright and Morning Star. Gabriel is occupied more with universe policies, Melchizedek with practical procedures. Gabriel presides over the regularly constituted tribunals and councils of Nebadon, Melchizedek over the special, extraordinary, and emergency commissions and advisory bodies. Gabriel and the Father Melchizedek are never away from Salvington at the same time, for in Gabriel's absence, the Father Melchizedek functions as the chief executive of Nebadon.
Okay, so let's do that second half, you know, second. Let's keep on this thing of understanding the nature of the Father Melchizedek and the clues that they're giving you to begin with there. Okay, so just in terms of administratively, he's, you know, he's sort of the deputy to Gabriel. But notice they give you some specifics. They're not interchangeable. The ones that are obviously a little more interchangeable with Gabriel, the ones they haven't revealed, that, you know, they were mentioning earlier here. This is a very different being. And look at the difference in their roles. Gabriel is occupied more with universe policies. Melchizedek with practical procedures. So think about the pattern that's getting expressed. Universal Father, you can call the Universal Father the Thought God. You can call the Eternal Son the Word God. Okay? The expression of the thought. Right? So the policies are the thought. Their expression, the word, is the practical procedures. Ah, so these two are in the, they're following the three paradise deities in pattern. So you're immediately going, well, who's the third one? Well, we'll get to that in the next paper. Okay, but you obviously have, you know, you're paralleling the Universal Father and the Eternal Son. Ah, but we're not totally just following the Eternal Son, are we? Because they reminded us it's the Eternal Mother's Son, right? Okay, so you have a pair, see again, that fits right in, that's a little more on the father-like, mother-like. As you've heard me mention other times, but here, you know, you're seeing the details where this comes from. So these first two primary sons that the Creator Son, the Created Mother Spirit create, the Bright Morning Star and Father Melchizedek, they're like those first two sons we talk about with our Adam and Eve, Adam's son and Eve's son. You know, there's Adam's son is short for Adam ben Adam, Adam son of Adam, okay? And Eve's son is short for Adam son of Eve, you know, Adam ben Eve. You know, Eve's son. Right? One, they're both sons, they're both Adams. But one is like Adam, father-like, and one is like Eve, mother-like. Right, you get the same thing here. You have two sons. One is father-like, one is mother-like. The father Melchizedek is the mother-like son. Okay? So think about, you know, I just mentioned in passing, you know, about the life carrier and that third creator and tied to the Paradise Trinity, and that Trinity's related to Mother. See, look at how we have a third element here that's similar. The third individual in a creative event that is has a Trinity aspect that's being fed in on super additively on top of, you know, some dual phenomenon. Okay. So that's the important thing to recognize. If you recognize that right up front about the Melchizedek, it's the very first thing that I'm teasing out of this is right up front. Then as you go forward, there's some things you can understand when they start to describe what Melchizedek's do, some abilities they have and whatnot. If you go, oh yeah, that's right, I don't want to forget about that mother, you know, bias in nature, that's going to give them some aspects that aren't there in, say, a Gabriel-like being. Okay?
Just so I could clarify, it's the creative spirit and the creator son who get together and make the father Melchizedek and also make Gabriel. But would it be too crude of a metaphor or analogy to say that it's like spiritual genetics and that
No, that's the whole point I'm trying to make.
Two sons with the same husband, one of my sons is going to be more like me, and another son could inherit more of the genetics of the father. That's what we're talking about.
Right.
And it's just specifying the infinite spirit is more the mother's
son. What you're beginning to understand is you have that basic sort of genetics, like dominant, recessive, and all that sort of stuff you talk about. There's a pattern on high. Okay, that doesn't originate with us. That starts all the way at the top. You know, spirit, energy, mind, energy, material energy, they're all literal energies. They all have literal laws. They all have literal genetics to them when you're talking about liaisons and bringing beings into existence.
So they're just
dominant, recessive, and all that stuff is in play.
When they throw that parenthetical in there, the daughter of the infinite spirit, they're just saying that they're not, I think it was a little bit confusing there.
They're just reminding you that it's not the creative spirit, period. That's, you know, the creative spirit can't make any beings in relationship with the creator son. Only the creative mother spirit can make a being. Remember? That's what we read back in paper 34.
Well, yeah. But it was the creative mother spirit that made Melchizedek too.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. But the whole point is, you know, a creative mother spirit has two types. A creative spirit just has one type of deity, spirit type deity. Has no mother deity. Right? But a creative mother spirit has two types of deity. Mother deity and spirit deity. And so if she's making a being, she could say, well, let me put the mother deity forward so it's the dominant and the spirit's the recessive. Or let me turn it around, put the spirit forward so the spirit is dominant and the mother's recessive. I was like, oh, I just figured out what the difference between Gabriel and Father Melchizedek are.
I just
right.
don't have that choice.
She puts, no, of course you don't. You
I
know.
Mean, but that's why I didn't understand that she could do that.
It's because she's a creator, not a creature. She has control over that as a creator. No creature has this kind of control. Creatures are just going with the flow that the creators want creatures to do. Okay, but that's all she's doing, see, fundamentally. I mean, there's obviously going to be all kinds of things I don't understand and we can't even begin to describe. But you can see the simple difference is just that. Does she put the existential spirit fact forward so it's dominant and you get a bright morning star that's more father-like, more existential-like? Or does she put the experiential deity, the mother deity, forward? So you get a Father Melchizedek, and the existential is recessive in the Father Melchizedek. Okay? That's the difference. You know? And you know, you can speculate about what's going on with the Creator's Son. The Creator's Son, remember, you know, we've talked about this a number of times. There's up front, you have father-type deity and son-type deity as both existential deity facts that can be put forward or whatnot. But recessively, there's mother deity in there too, because his parent was not the eternal son. His parent was the eternal mother son. The eternal son didn't make any beings, okay? Eternal, it's only when you had the eternal mother son. And so there's mother deity in there too. And so what, you know, what role does it have? You know, you can imagine, it's like, well, what if the creative mother spirit has the mother deity in the recessive mode, but you could get a recessive mother-mother combination. Maybe that gives rise to one of the unrevealed sons. These sorts of things. See, there's all kinds of things you could speculate, see, on what might be going on with, because there's all of these possibilities. Now, you know, right now he's a master son and he has supreme type deity, but remember he does not allowed to create anymore.
What?
He has supreme type deity now, but he's not allowed to create anymore. Okay? Because you can't feed supreme type deity directly into creatures in the finite domain. Yeah. He will get to do that in the next age. When he's an absonite being, you know, as a creator, he'll get to feed that supreme deity into his offspring. You know, and remember, they refer to that at that one point. They can hardly wait for the next age to see what's going to come out of, you know, that combination. You know, kind of liaisons are you going to get then?
Out of,
you know, the master son and the creative mother spirit in the next universe age, when he can put supreme type deity into. You know, into a creative act. Yep.
How did you say the Trinity fits into this? You were alluding to.
So, whenever you have mother deity, what's behind mother deity? The Trinity. You know, right. So the Trinity is always in play there. And seeing that but you can have the Trinity sort of just engaging in the process indirectly via mother deity, or you can imagine the Trinity entering in directly. Like with an Ancient of Days, okay? There's no mother deity to an Ancient of Days. You know, they're just pure existential Trinity origin beings. You know, so they have the type of deity that came directly from the Paradise Trinity. You know, and so if they participate in a creative act, you're getting raw Trinity-type deity, see, being fed in. Now, it's obviously Trinity of supremacy. I mean, it wasn't the Trinity of absoluteness that made those finite beings. It wasn't the Trinity of ultimacy that made those finite beings, those first beings on the finite personality record, the Ancients of Days. I mean, it was the Trinity of supremacy. You know, but you've got, you know, as much Trinity as you can put into the finite, going, you know, raw directly into a creative act. You know, no modification in the context of mother deity or anything. It's just the Trinity is directly participating in that. You know, so a life carrier is a, you know, partial Trinity origin, existential, you know, Trinity origin being. Right? Okay. And that's sort of an asterisk, you know, that's always there. We'll get to that when we get to the, you know, the next paper. But anyway, so back to these. So this is fundamentally what you have. Just, you know, we're seeing this genetics again. You know, of energy high and low of every form. It has this basic dominant recessive, you know, whatnot, you know, sort of genetics going on. And you've got a more mother-dominated son being made here. And that's going to give these Melchizedeks an ability that a father-like son doesn't have. Okay, some variability that they would, you know, that those types of sons don't have. Oh, that's right. Yeah, because the rest of it. It's a tiny paragraph, but we forgot the whole second half of it. Okay, yeah, let's get to the rest of it because that's fun stuff too. Gabriel presides over the regularly constituted tribunals and councils, Melchizedek over the special extraordinary emergency. Okay, so again, you have, you have the rule, sort of, and that, and Gabriel's involved in the things that are the rule, and then you have the Melchizedek, Father Melchizedek and the Melchizedeks in general, that are involved in the exceptions to the rule. Okay? There's that basic contrast. You know, and again, it's in that practical procedure, universe policy thing. You know, the policies are the rules, and, you know, and practical procedures, you know, invariably involve exceptions to the rules. Right? Sometimes they're going to be extraordinary, extraordinary, you know, and emergency situations. Okay, and, you know, and then the classic thing. Gabriel and the father Melchizedek are never away from Salvington at the same time, for in Gabriel's absence, the father Melchizedek functions as the chief executive of Nebadon. And as we all know, both Gabriel and the father Melchizedek were on this planet simultaneously during the seventh bestowal 2,000 years ago. So what's the exception? I mean, they just gave you the rule. What's the exception to that rule that was in play? Bestowals mean that universes don't need rulers?
No.
No, that doesn't make sense.
Move the headquarters here?
No.
The Union of Days
was in charge.
Right. Emmanuel was in charge.
Right.
That's the exception to this rule. Right. The only reason that they could both be here, because there was an exceptional, an extraordinary, a singular time when the Union of Days took the rulership. Okay? Right? So they can both be here. You know, the fact that longtime, you know, readers still trip over this and, you know, think they've found a mistake in the book or something, it's like, no, no, no. I mean, right there in that paragraph, before they tell you that rule, they gave you, you know, rule, exception. You know, if you haven't noticed that in the first part of the paragraph, you haven't set up your understanding for the last sentence. There's rules and exceptions. I mean, if anything, if you recognize that you're not in a domain of absoluteness, it shouldn't be surprising that rules have exceptions. But if you have spent your whole religious life favoring your existential consciousness and your relationship to the existential God, God the Father, you are definitely going to have a tendency to absolutize and existentialize everything you think about, and you will trip over that constantly.
They say almost never instead of
never. Again, because the rule is never. See, that's the rule. But there's exceptions to rules. See, what you got to figure out, what are they stating? Are they giving you a history sentence or a sentence that states what's in the rule book? Okay, that's what they're giving. That's the thing. I mean, it's like if you assume they're giving you a history lesson, then you found a mistake in the revelation or whatever you want to call it, an error or whatever, a boo-boo. Again, like they told you, every sentence in the book you can misinterpret. They're written so that you can misinterpret every one of them. It's written just like Jesus' parables. He purposely said his parables so you could misinterpret every single thing he said, so that you had full opportunity for sin expression and confusion. There is no leading you to paradise. You don't get to paradise, you know, by one step of grace in the end. Because even the things that get you started by grace, you have to take a hold of those things by choice eventually, or you're not going to get to paradise. The only thing that gets to paradise is choice, 100% pure choice. Not one shred of, I gave you an exception and you got to take five steps free. No such thing. Everything is designed like this. Everything is a test. You know, the Urantia book is a test, and you can fail it or pass it. And it's designed. It has to do with recognizing first and interpreting second.
Well, it was true probably 2001 years ago, but after Jesus, it wasn't true.
No, it's still true. They didn't change what's written in their record, in their law book. The law still says.
They're both gone.
I know, but do you understand what I'm saying?
See, it's extraordinary.
That's the exception to this rule.
What does it say is a rule?
It says extraordinary.
Well, okay, and that's what I'm trying to get at. It doesn't say it's a rule. Before you interpret it, you have to recognize. The recognition step is never in the words. The thing that you have to recognize before you interpret any sentence in the book is not any words in the sentence. This is the most important thing to understand about the revelation. And it's like, well, then it's impossible. No, God gave you an upper domain of the hourglass and three cosmic intuitions, an ability to recognize, okay? And the way it works is, if you start with the proper initial assumption, you won't result in error. If you start with the wrong initial assumption, you'll end in error. So it's a simple test. If you assume it's a history sentence, that immediately leads to the discovery that the book is in disagreement with itself. Okay, therefore it's not a revelation, it's not the authoritative elimination of error, it's nothing but error, and should be just discarded. Okay, now you have a decision point. Is that what you want to abide with, or do you know otherwise? Okay, do you know? No, it's the authoritative elimination of error. There's not one single error in the entire book. Not one. And typos are not errors. To call a typo an error is an error. That's an unwise judgment. An error is an unwise judgment. Calling a typo an error is an unwise judgment.
It's Merritt's fault.
Okay? Very important to get this. You've got to get this step. Or there is nothing in the book except things to trip over. You know, if you don't recognize first, smart people are going to constantly crop up. that are going to convince you that the book is in error. Okay? You have to just know that it's not, and you need to try a better initial assumption than they're giving you that doesn't result in error. It's not a matter of rationalizing. Rationalizing is the process that happens after the initial assumption. It's about the initial assumption, which can't be seen. It has to, you know, with the eyes, with sight. It can only be seen with insight. It's not in the words. You've got to see that.
It's possible then. Right? You know, I just went and read where it says that Jesus, they were together.
Right, right.
But then again, you might be able to read that. They said that that's who he was really talking to, not necessarily that they were here.
Right. So now you're giving what is very important to understand. The other thing that's very important to understand is you can rationalize anything. I can start with any false initial assumption and get the correct answer. So I can start with any assumption. I can start out with Marilyn Monroe as my initial assumption, and I can rationalize what the deal is, you know, with Gabriel and Father Melchizedek on your ranch 2,000 years ago. Okay, you can rationalize anything.
Well, just like you did by saying that they were here because Emmanuel was rationalizing.
No, it's not. And that's the thing. There's a difference. Subjectively, they look exactly the same. They both sound like a sequence of words that started with an initial assumption and got the answer you were looking for, you know, that you can rationalize everything in the book. But the two initial assumptions are not the same. And how do you discriminate between them? You have three discriminators that you were given by God that can know whether an initial assumption is correct or not without any deductive reasoning. The two assumptions will feel different. And you have to choose. That's the whole test from here to paradise. They're going to give you endless experiences that can be rationalized in an infinite number of ways. You have to figure out what the correct initial assumption is. And the only way that you can tell is not whether or not you get the correct answer, but how the initial assumption feels with your insight. Does it feel right or wrong, true or false? I'm stressing this because the main reason that we have this book in our laps is humans cannot do this anymore. Most humans don't even know there is this distinction. Okay, between that which is merely rational and that which is logical. Which is also rational. So you give them a logical statement and you give them a merely rational statement and they say they're identical because all they see is the rationalization, the deductive reasoning.
But then you're going to be questioning everything.
Yes, that's the whole point. To question everything. Because what this book is about is the ideas, every single idea you have about everything. They're trying to get you to call into question. Okay? Not the ideals. Okay? Ideals are fine. But like I tried to point out, the first paragraph of the book, all the way to the last sentence, it doesn't say you have a problem with ideals. It says it's about ideas. Yeah? When all is said and done, the Father ideal, no, it doesn't say that, does it? When all is said and done, the Father idea. Okay? The book is all about ideas, and ideas stem, the linchpin of the whole phenomenon of ideas is that initial assumption, that recognition step. You know, the reason that you need to reawaken philosophy, the reason that you have to reform the whole thing is because, not because there hasn't been really smart people who can rationalize like nobody's business. The problem is there hasn't been appropriate insightful people with the help of a revelation, to start with the correct initial assumption. Okay? I'm just trying to, I'm trying to help you in the long term. Like, if you are earnestly wanting to be a follower of the fifth epical revelation, the more it gets out there, the more really smart people are going to grab a hold of it. And they're going to show you how it's wholly in error. They are well smart enough to show you how every single sentence in here is in direct contradiction to everything we know. Okay? That's what Lucifer was doing on Gerasim, day in and day out. He was lecturing, showing people how even very intelligent spiritual beings, how there was a different rationalization. And, you know, they came up to Gabriel, and they said, Gabriel, why aren't you stepping forward and speaking on Michael's behalf? And in so many words, he says, well, I could put another sequence of words out there, another rational line of reasoning, okay? But if you can't distinguish between correct and incorrect initial assumptions, if you're not sophistry proof, we're not interested in you because you're not real. And it's best that you cease to exist because you don't really exist right now. The test is whether or not you can see that Lucifer's initial assumptions, which are in none of his words, not a single one of his words expresses the initial assumption. It's the unseen thing, unheard thing. That's what you're trying to get the ability to penetrate. Okay? You know, when some great mind gives you a line of reasoning, do all you see is the reasoning, or do you see the initial assumption?
This seems a little inconsistent in the way you teach the class, because when you go through this, you know, you really dwell on the word. Sometimes you go into the Latin of the word.
I do.
Chose that word,
this
meaning.
Yeah, I do. And you notice, you just parroted, I say, they chose this word because of, and you should be saying, says who, Chris? Says who? Okay? I mean, how am I to say that I know why they chose a particular word? Okay? What's my response? Certitude of the divine. Who am I if I cannot say why they chose it? Who am I if I cannot say that? I'm the one that Gabriel said, we're not interested in you. You cry, Lord, Lord, and I tell you, I never knew you. Okay? You don't want to be that person. You want to know what the revelators meant. You have to find the truth. The truth is not in the words. And the truth is rooted in the initial assumptions, which are not in the words. You've got to figure out what it feels like to get a hold of the correct initial assumptions. Okay? I can tell you that the correct etymology of a particular coined word in a book is blank. And you can say, well, no, I have a different one. I can say, well, I actually found 12 different ones. Okay, but I told you that one is true, because I recognized that the others were false. Quid est veritas? What is truth? Okay, who am I if I know not the truth? If you want to know what you are, if you know not the truth, read what it says right after the cosmic fruits of the Spirit. What God does with those who know not the truth.
Branches off.
And burns them. Right? It's very strong language. It will be cast into the fire, those dead branches. Okay? Now, do you put that into the present moment? No. We're not required to be second milers first. That's a second miler fact. Okay, you have the grace of first milership. But miles are to be walked. And miles of the first mile of childhood reaches a threshold of adulthood at some point. You know, there comes a point when you have to make the transition from first miler to second miler. Okay, and then the binary thing is in play. If you don't have truth, you don't go on. If you don't have truth, do you go from Gerasim to the constellation? No, not a single individual. They've all been sorted out by then. Right?
If you desire, you will eventually get
it. Right. Right. You know, it's not, you got to be careful about the first miler thing. It's not literally a mile and you're walking at a given pace and, you know, before you're ready, you're going to get to the, you know, the 2 mile mark. Yeah. Okay. No. I mean, you know, you can spend the next 20 million years on the mansion worlds if you need to. Okay. But eventually, you know, you're not going to be on the mansion worlds forever. Somewhere between 20 million years and forever, you're going to leave the Mansion Worlds. Okay? And you do that because you finally have gotten to the point where you're sophistry proof, where you see initial assumptions as clearly as you see reasoning, where you see truth as clearly as you see fact. You know? You gotta, you know, this is what we're striving for. And it begins with this magnificent text they've given us that's a great place to start this, you know, and they've constructed it so there's all kinds of opportunities to start with a false initial assumption, and if you have any awareness outside of a particular paragraph, you'll eventually find another paragraph that is in conflict with the initial assumption that you took to rationalize that previous paragraph. You'll come to that. And if you remember, if you have both paragraphs in your head at the same time, you go, wait a minute, the initial assumption I have for this paragraph to rationalize it is different than the initial assumption to rationalize this one. Something is not correct. Most likely, both of those initial assumptions are incorrect, and you need a third.
What comes to mind for me is the difference between I have faith in this revelation of truth, or I trust this revelation of truth. And as long as I'm in that, as I do trust, then I must readjust my initial assumptions if I'm having a problem with it.
And the way you come about that, it's not just two words that you choose from. To go from faith to trust, it's an experiential process. I trust the revelation. I'm speaking like I am right now so definitively because I've proven this to myself. How do you know it's a revelation? They tell you point blank in a sentence. You remember the sentence? The only way that you can know this is a revelation is experientially. You have to put it to the test. You know, if you just rationalize, you're not putting anything to the test. And you can always rationalize it. You can always come up with some reason if you're smart enough. And if you're not smart enough, go get another person who is smarter and they'll do it for you. They can rationalize it for you. But you don't want to know how to rationalize it. You want to know the truth that flows through it. And there's one unified assumption that you can overlay on it, and then everything flows. You know, where you never have an ad hoc circumstance. You know, to get around this little difficulty, I bring in this other idea. You never have to bring in another idea. You've got a unified picture. And that's what you're looking for. All right, and okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Got a question. Mm-hmm. Winston wants to know, do ideas produce rationalization does rationalization produce ideas?
The latter. Now, technically, an idea, in its true meaning of the word, an idea involves the reflective interpretations of a personal self. It involves putting an initial mind form into an objective context, and that's a genuine idea. But, there's sort of idea-like things. A rationalization is taking a form in your mind and giving it a direction. Okay? But what you're trying to do is give it the proper direction. You're trying to put it into the big picture, and that's going to take some. You're going to have to be able to see the cosmos with your insight, and then compare it with this. Oh, it fits in like that. Okay, and it flows that way. So, now I have an idea about that form. Yeah, I've added these reflective interpretations to it. But, you know, you're doing subjective things like that all the time. And that's why I say that's the interpret part, see, technically. But you got to recognize first. Discover the book, then recognize the correct initial assumptions, then interpret, and then choose. Discover, recognize, interpret, and choose. Okay? You know, you get to the last section in the book, and they give you that sequence, see? They're trying to sum it all up. It's like, okay, you've read through the whole book now. Okay, can you go through this sequence? You know, you've read it, so you discovered it. But have you recognized before you interpreted? If you skip the recognition, and it's sad to record there's so few persons on the planet that even know there is recognition in between discovery and interpretation. Okay, if you've just discovered it and interpreted it, what's the assumptions that you've used to interpret it with? Your preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices. Your old worldview, your old wineskins. Okay, so you haven't gained anything. You have the bag just as the master gave you when you buried it, right?
Maybe that's as far as you are yet.
Sure. But again, one must do something as well as be something, right? See, the whole point of a revelation is to reveal truth.
And there's two ways.
They want you to get to that point.
Yes, you can study it, you can understand it intellectually, but then the living of it and the actual loving and being able to put the words into life, so to speak, that's a whole other thing unto itself, other than, as you say, you know, really understanding it, really picturing it, really getting it, you know, all the way through, but then there's more to it than that.
Exactly. What I've been saying, the whole point of what I've been saying is that. Why would I want to get the truth instead of just the facts? Because I can't obey facts. I can't live facts. I can only live truth. You can only obey truth. You can't obey facts. See, so if all you have is the facts in the book, the words, you've memorized, you know, how many worlds around this, that, and the other thing, and all these sorts of things, you can't live that. Your life will coincidentally be a lot like it was before you memorized all those facts. Because you can't obey those facts. It doesn't matter if the facts were disclosed by celestial beings, you still can't obey them. Okay? You can't obey facts. That's why you want to get the truth, because it's living and you can obey it. Why do you languish in futile yearning? Because you obey not the truth. Okay, well, if quid est veritas, if you don't have the truth, obviously you can't obey it. Before you can obey the truth, you have to know the truth. See, know it. You know, that's an intellectual problem. It's your thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you Godward. Right? To get to that point where you can really live, you have to do an intellectual process of getting to knowing the truth. Moving up Godward until you can know truth. You can't know it, you know, with your agitated mind. You can only know it with your spiritualized mind. You've got to know the truth. And once you know it, once you've gone through this process we've been describing, now you've got something you can start to obey. And your life will be different after that. Okay? Relationships will go differently than they did before. Your job will go differently than it did before. Et cetera, et cetera. But until you have that truth, you're caught in a circle.
Yeah?
You just go around and around and around. Okay? You know, and what do you, I mean, just one more thought. I mean, just try to help you visualize this. You know, that whole bit of going around chasing your tail, you know, sort of a quasi reincarnation day in and day out, you know, where you just repeat what you did the day before, you know, like Groundhog Day. Okay, what are you orbiting about? I mean, if you're going in a circle, there must be something at the center. You know, you can't go around nothing. There's something you're going around and around. What are you going around? A fact. There's some fact point that you're orbiting, that's the center of your universe, that's your sun, you know, in your solar system, your S-U-N, see? You're orbiting it. Truth is a line that goes through that fact and gets you out of that circle. You've got to find the truth. All right. Let's see. All right, so just, you know, I'm here, you know, putting forward what I've recognized, and you know, I'm trying to help you. You know, I went through a long process. I tried lots of different initial assumptions, and they didn't work. And then I found the correct one. And it's so obvious when you find it, it's like, okay, without any rationalization, it's just there, okay? I don't have to jump through any hoops. I don't have to be smarter than I am, you know, to think up that really clever way of rationalizing it like Bob did, okay? You know, my burden is light, he said, you know? His burden is truth, okay? If you find the truth, you know, it's dynamic. You can just go with its flow. You don't have to burn those rationalization calories. Okay, so at the very least, you know, I'm saying try it like this. Don't believe what I'm saying. Try it out. Okay, use your mind. Start with that initial assumption and see where it goes. See if you like where it takes you. If you don't, you know, go find another initial assumption. Again, you know. Not even God can help us with our initial assumptions. It's up to us. He gave it, it's in our hands what we choose for our initial assumptions. All right, let's keep going here.
The Melchizedeks of our universe were all created within one millennial period of standard time by the Creator Son and the Creative Spirit in liaison with the Father Melchizedek. Being an order of sonship wherein one of their own number functioned as coordinate creator, Melchizedeks are in constitution partly of self-origin and therefore candidates for the realization of a supernal type of self-government. They periodically elect their own administrative chief for a term of 7 years of standard time and otherwise function as a self-regulating order, though the original Melchizedek does exercise certain inherent co-parental prerogatives. From time to time, this Father Melchizedek designates certain individuals of his order to function as special life carriers to the Midsonite worlds, a type of inhabited planet not heretofore revealed on Urantia.
Okay, and we'll get to the Midsonite worlds in the next paper again. They keep foreshadowing the next paper here. Okay, so let's start with a fact. Okay, one millennial period of standard time. Does anyone happen to remember that fact? How much difference is there between our local universe year and one of our years?
Five.
Yep. All right. So it's 5,000 of our years. I wanted to go through that fact because it's not that different than 1,000 years. Okay, so it's a relatively short time, whether you put it in standard time or our time. You know, okay, it's not very long. So there, one standard millennium. I don't know, but you know, they're basically just saying sort of one kind of full cycle. Boom, you brought them all into existence, and then that's it. In a relatively short time, in other words. Okay, so they're giving you that little fact point that in terms of their creating them, there's not a long span of time that their nature might be synchronized with, you know, where this one strikes steps with the Supreme now and this one strikes steps with the Supreme 5 billion years later. You know, the Supreme relatively doesn't change over that little short span of time. So they have a very tight nature, that binds them naturally together into a pretty solid group, and they're pointing that out. They can self-govern really well. See, it's this nice, tight little group. They don't have to deal with the differential of the Supreme over billions of years, you know, between one of them was created and the other one was created. Okay, and creation was different.
Chris, what are they made of? Spirit substance?
So, they, in terms of what you think about what they're made out of, like I said, they're not God, so you don't want to think of them as being made out of deity substance, okay? But they all have a body, you know, and we obviously call them spirit beings. But remember, they try to remind you that's just a contrasting term. You know, you definitely don't want to think of them as being made out of flesh and blood like this. Technically, what they're made out of is you take spirit energy and physical energy, some measures and some flavors, and you homogeneously blend it all together and you make a body out of it. You know, every one of these beings has a different mixture of spirit energy and material energy or physical energy. You know, five cups of this to one cup of that, and then you blend it together.
Being created by their parents, so to speak. Mm-hmm.
Right.
These beings.
Right. Just like the way you had a literal sex and non-sex liaison between two the prince's staff, and there's no womb. A primary midwayer just appears there. Right. Now it's not magical. There is, like I'm saying, there's some sort of an energy womb. Okay, you have a domain within that which that being materializes, you know, that is active and energy and you know, domain that's, you know, energy active.
It's a 3D printer.
Yeah, right. It's like a 3D printer. Yeah. We actually kind of have an analogy now. Yeah. Right. So they're just doing the same thing. Like I said, I mean, there's some region that is effectively the womb. Okay. You know, there's an energy region, you know, maybe, you know, does it have some sort of a cocoon sort of a thing? I mean, or is it, I don't know how they, you know, in some way it's obviously localized, you know, they're not, you know, they don't just do this and then hunt around the local universe and try to figure out where they came into existence. I mean, they somehow are localizing their energy, you know.
But they're fully developed and knowledgeable and everything,
right? Right, immediately. So there's no maturation process like we experience. Just like with the, you know, I mean, it's
you're not there, then all of a sudden you're there and you're fully everything you need to be.
You know, and for me at least,
that seems magical to me.
For me, it doesn't seem so strange for creator beings to do that, but two creatures doing that,
yeah.
You know, two of those staff members that were so doofus that they actually joined the rebellion. I mean, those two meatheads got together. And they just made this being that's a full adult being, you know. I mean, that's a pretty interesting little trick. Seems kind of magical, I agree. See? But again, see, they're trying to get us to remember. The reason it seems magical to us is we're not used to thinking of energy beyond this sort of simple stuff. You know, we don't appreciate that this room is chocked full every square inch with energy that we can't see and can't interact with. No, no. Only matter is made out of automatons. Mind energy is not made out of automatons. Spirit energy is not made out of automatons. Just the material energy made out of automatons. Yeah. All right. So again, with, you know, there's physical energy in the body of all these different beings, seraphim, Melchizedek, whatever, and it's all in different blends, and it's, you know. So, you know, you're talking about beings that have a large fraction of spirit energy relative to physical energy. You know, more so, say, than a seraphim. They tell you that the highest spirit beings in the local universe that are made in large numbers are the archangels. So in terms of that balance of how many cups of spirit energy per cup of physical energy, the archangels, they tell you, are the ones with large numbers, where it's just a very, you know, 20 cups spirit energy and one thimble of, you know, physical energy, and, you know, blend thoroughly and make a body out of it. Okay. And so these creator beings can literally control the energies. They can grab a hold of the energies and mold them into bodies. Yeah, and then of course she, you know, engages mind to it because she's the mind minister. You know, so once they make the body, she bestows mind upon it and the Holy Spirit onto it. You know, so they have the three cosmic intuitions, and you know, And again, the kind of mind is that like we talked about, is the, you know, it's not adjutant mind, it's the mind that's parallel to Maranatha mind. And, you know, if it's an archangel, it's going to be parallel to the Maranatha mind that you have when you're way up close to graduating from the local universe. It's going to be way on the spirit side of the scale, right? Right. So now Melchizedek, as we're going to, you know, if we get to it here, they're a very interesting being, as we'll see here. Okay, so let's see. What have we done here? Let's see. Okay, so we had... okay, let's get in the rest of this paragraph. So they're reminding you about this thing, you know, in liaison. See, like I said, you know, they literally use the word liaison, so, you know, it's not physical sex, but it's whatever the equivalent is, you know, at a higher level. They're literally in liaison, energy liaison. They're intermeshing their energy systems, okay? And the Father Melchizedek goes right in there with that. Okay? All right. It's just literal, that literal. Okay, now look at how they see. See, again, notice the subtleties. Being an order of sonship wherein one of their own number functioned as coordinate creator. Okay, if I capitalize this two C's on coordinate creator, I get an alternate designation for the eternal mother son. Right? You know, technically when you make a creator son, you know, that's the universal creator, the father, the universal father as the universal creator, I should say God the Father as the universal creator, and God the Son as the coordinate creator. The two get together and create a creator son. So just see, like I said, this Melchizedek definitely has mother, you know, coordinates a mother word or Trinity word. Okay, yeah. So like I said, see, that's they're trying to remind you. It's very much a mother-like interface into this process as a coordinate creator. So then, like we said, they're created over this short period of time, so they're very tightly grouped together in nature, so they can really all get on the same mindal page. They can be kindred minds quite easily, quite naturally, and so self-government is just right there. They don't have to go through, you know, millions of years of evolution to finally become enough kindred minds that they can, you know, self-govern. They've got that kindred mind thing pretty much right from the get-go by nature. So they've got all that. But as you'd expect, you know, it remains that the Father Melchizedek is different. You know, and like I said, sometimes he actually is parent to them as children. Even way down the road, you know, if for no other reason, he's, you know, it's kind of second in charge, you know, after Gabriel. So, yeah, he has to tell beings, including the Melchizedeks, what to do. Let's see. Let's go on to the next one.
The Melchizedeks do not function extensively outside the local universe, except when they are called as witnesses in matters pending before the tribunals of the super universe, and when designated special ambassadors, as they sometimes are, representing one universe to another in the same super universe. The original or firstborn Melchizedek of each universe is always at liberty to journey to the neighboring universes or to paradise on missions having to do with the interests and duties of his order.
Okay, so just one little thing besides the immediate facts there. We talked about this. This is true of every local universe being. Okay, we just talked about molding a body for this Melchizedek, and then she, you know, engages it with mind. You know, they're minded by her, and she has a boundary. A being that's minded by her can't go outside the local universe. Okay, unless they're modified so that, you know, the reflective mother spirits are giving them mind. You know, and they're really kind of more in the super universe context of mind rather than the local universe context of mind. So, you know, if they talk about one of them, you know, being sent outside the local universe, you know, your first thought is, okay, well, apparently they were modified. And it seems to be backed up because look what they say. The firstborn Melchizedek of each universe is always at liberty to journey. So maybe he's different, see, right from the beginning. Probably Gabriel's the same way. They're probably both made so that they're not minded by her to start with. They're probably plugged into the super universe mind to begin with. Okay, so they can function in a greater context right away. But, yeah, and then there's all those issues, but let's not go into all the details of what that implies of being able to go outside of the super universe. But yeah, see, you have to consider those issues. There's occasionally, you know, for lower beings, they will say it directly. You know, like if a seraphim is going to go outside, they say before they go outside, they go back into liaison with the creative mother spirit and she modifies them. And then they can go. I mean, what's she doing? She's unplugging her mind and modifying them and plugging them into the mind of the reflective mother spirit so that they can go outside of the local universe. Okay. But see, it just sounds like always at liberty. So apparently, he's plugged in higher up to start with. So,
quick question.
Yep.
Their speed.
Okay.
Would they be sort of like heck of a long time to get?
The Melchizedeks themselves, every indication is they're, they can't self-transport. They've got to be transported by the transport seraphim. You know, so three times the speed of light.
So if you went to paradise, that'd take a
while. Oh, yeah. All right. But now, Father Melchizedek is different. I was just about to point that out. And Gabriel is most likely different. And so, the reason you can be, you have some sort of immediate avenue to speculate that the Father Melchizedek might be able to self-transport and might be able to go faster is that relationship to the Trinity. Remember, the one clue we have about this whole transport thing, about being able to self-transport, is if you have a direct relationship to the Trinity. You know, back when you're reading about the Trinity origin beings, that the Divine Counselor said, okay, the reason I can self-transport is because of my direct relationship to the Trinity, you know, and here's my speed and stuff, okay? See, and that's the mystery of the transport seraphim. Here you have these beings that seem to be just offspring of the infinite spirit, but they're showing the signs of being, you know, they can not only transport other beings, but, you know, they can transport themselves, see? Okay? You know, they can do that Trinity thing. I tried to point that out. I mean, remember, fundamentally you have this relationship between the Paradise Trinity and the Infinite Spirit that's powering, bringing all these beings into existence and everything. And so that's a simple example. The mystery there is you've got a being that it seems like it's all just about the Infinite Spirit, but it's never all just about the Infinite Spirit. It's just the Infinite Spirit might be up front, and when you watch the creative act, it seems like it's just coming out of the Infinite Spirit. But what's the recessive fact behind that? The Paradise Trinity. And, you know, at times that recessive fact comes out, like in Transport Seraphim, where they have a relationship to the Paradise Trinity that allows them to navigate themselves. And then on top of that, you can piggyback on them. Okay? So, you know, you might suspect, see, that these beings that might need to go to Paradise and stuff like that, see, to think that they are limited to three times the speed of light, you know, pretty darn, you know, it's like when we were talking about us. You know, when we go from Uversa to the pilot world of the seventh circuit of Avona, that's a long journey, because we go at three times the speed of light. All right, let's get some more here.
Two, the Melchizedek sons. The Melchizedeks are the first order of divine sons to approach sufficiently near the lower creature life to be able to function directly in the ministry of mortal uplift, to serve the evolutionary races without the necessity of incarnation. These sons are naturally at the midpoint of the great personality descent. by origin being just about midway between the highest divinity and the lowest creature life of will endowment. They thus become the natural intermediaries between the higher and divine levels of living existence and the lower, even the material, forms of life on the evolutionary worlds. The seraphic orders, the angels, delight to work with the Melchizedeks. In fact, all forms of intelligent life find in these sons understanding friends, sympathetic teachers, and wise counselors.
Okay, so here's the first point where we can use what we've recognized about their nature in this relationship to Mother Deity. Okay, I mean, you have all these facts describing them, you know, the whole thing of, you know, neatly kind of picturing them as midway and all this. And here's where they start to get you to notice a very amazing thing about Melchizedeks, okay, where it says, they thus become the natural intermediaries between the higher and divine levels of living existence and the lower, even the material forms of life on the evolutionary worlds. We get forward a little bit more. They'll tell us for the first time that Melchizedeks have the ability in and of their own nature to modify their form, their body form, without incarnating. He can just turn an internal knob in his body and make himself material. So, like, for instance, you know, if you have those Melchizedeks that serve with an Avonal son, and the Avonal's doing the incarnation thing, he's doing it materially, you know, and they serve with him materially, they don't have to be incarnated, those Melchizedeks. They just make themselves physically. So what are they made out of? What are their body made out of? Yeah, now it's really hard to understand. Their body is made out of something, like it's made out of like all the different ratios and variations of spirit and
shapeshifter.
Yeah, they're like a shapeshifter. They literally, you know, now I have a body like an angel, and I can directly, you know, remember the angels love them, like they say. See, they can engage them as an angel, basically. Energetically, they're like an angel. Or they can engage us energetically like they were our kind of material flesh and blood. After all, we're going to read about the Midsoniter things and the next thing that they alluded to. Remember, you've got a Melchizedek in the role of the Adam, quote unquote, with literally a material daughter, just a regular old material daughter. Okay, to make babies with her, you got to have sex with her. Okay, so he's not exactly some fuzzy, you know, ephemeral spirit being. He has to literally be able to make himself material and engage her materially, sexually, to give rise to Midsoniters. Okay, and he can do that without incarnation. So how can he do this? How can he dial himself up and down this whole spectrum that we imagine of very high spirit-like, and, you know, and ones that are very, you know, even right down to the material level? What gives him vertical extent?
Trinity relation.
Mother Deity, right? What's the big difference between those existential deities and Mother Deity? Mother Deity has a vertical dimension to it. Father Deity or Son Deity or Spirit Deity. Now, see, that's why he's given that mother-like nature. So it's so much so that they have this vertical mother-like energy body. They exist at the whole, you know, from the lowest level of local universe beings to the highest level, all at the same time, and they can dial at what level they manifest, but internally they embody the whole range.
You know, they make a point of telling us the Macaventa had his first meal.
Right. Now, Macaventa, though, incarnated. We're going to read about that. That's different. He actually incarnated. Totally different. If a Melchizedek makes himself physical I mean, doesn't incarnate, doesn't get an adjuster, there's no soul, you know, he's just a Melchizedek. That's what Melchizedeks are, is beings that can manifest at all different energy levels. Like secondary midwares, you know, they have a little vertical range that they can manifest over. Well, if a secondary midwayer has a vertical range, what does that tell you? They must have a relationship to experiential deity. Remember, I've pointed that out before. Remember when we were going through paper 30, and in the place of the unrevealed angels, you know, at that low level, you know, they throw in the midwayers, you know, because, you know, you have these two parallel lines. You have the ones that are the angels, which are tied to existential deity and function at a given level, period, right? But then parallel to that, we at least have midwayers revealed. There must be a whole bunch of beings, see, parallel at all sorts of levels, beings that are related to experiential deity. And the overarching all experiential deity is the mother type deity, just like overarching all existential deity is the father type deity. See, they have a relationship to mother type deity. That's, or they couldn't, dial themselves up and down vertically like that, over that little bit of range, where the Melchizedeks can dial themselves over the whole great range. And so it's handy they put them in the middle, you know. So you turn the knob halfway one way and you go all the way up, and halfway the other way and you go all the way down. They're put in the middle, so it's shorter distance.
So that's a body made out of mother deity.
It's substance. A body made out of physical energy that is very mother deity like, and it's it's going to be. I mean, especially the father Melchizedek, undoubtedly is going to be like. Close to being God, close to being personalized deity. He's probably, remember, and we pointed this out, Gabriel is the same way in another mode. You know, he's not a creator, but he's a procreator. So you've got these two, Father Melchizedek and Gabriel are beings that are sort of right there on the edge of being personalized deity. And here you're seeing, in this case, the deity nearness is related to mother, and it gives them this verticalness, you know, that they can, so that I mean, you know, probably what you can think of it is their body has a relationship to deity that's very intimate. That, so it's basically the deity that provides the means of being vertical, and it just tunes into that deity at different levels. Okay. How much the mother is actually involved, you know, the creative mother spirit, say, is involved in that process of them morphing, I don't know, or whatnot, but anyway. All right, so that's what they're getting at there. This relationship to mother gives them this morphability in the vertical dimension. Okay, and that comes in very handy for some of the things they need to do. All right, let's keep going here.
The Melchizedeks are a self-governing order. With this unique group, we encounter the first attempt at self-determination on the part of local universe beings and observe the highest type of true self-government. These sons organize their own machinery for their group and home planet administration, as well as that for the six associated spheres and their tributary worlds. And it should be recorded that they have never abused their prerogatives. Not once throughout all the super universe of Orvantan have these Melchizedek sons ever betrayed their trust. They are the hope of every universe group which aspires to self-government. They are the pattern and the teachers of self-government to all the spheres of Nebadon. All orders of intelligent beings, superiors from above and subordinates from below, are wholeheartedly in their praise of the government of the Melchizedeks, or wholehearted.
Mm-hmm. So, just stressing, we'll come back to that later, this integrity of their self-government. And we'll also come back to this other thing they throw out here. The sons organize their own machinery for their group and home planet administration. We'll come back to that later and contemplate that. But, you know, in just the way the whole, their worlds are set up, it's all in their charge. but we'll get to why they word it that way later on. Okay, keep going.
The Melchizedek order of sonship occupies the position and assumes the responsibility of the eldest son in a large family. Most of their work is regular and somewhat routine, but much of it is voluntary and altogether self-imposed. A majority of the special assemblies which from time to time convene on Salvington are called on motion of the Melchizedeks. On their own initiative, these sons patrol their native universe. They maintain an autonomous organization devoted to universe intelligence, making periodical reports to the Creator Son, independent of all information coming up to universe headquarters, through the regular agencies concerned with the routine administration of the realm. They are by nature unprejudiced observers. They have the full confidence of all classes of intelligent beings.
Okay, just a one little item in there. This little statement they throw in to help us with this tension we've spoken about a number of times. So they start out saying, most of their work is regular and somewhat routine. And your, you know, heart drops as you contemplate a, you know, an eternity of mundane labor. But much of it is voluntary and altogether self-imposed. Right, trying to remind you, you know, to don't judge these statements, you know, with your ease-drifting soul. You know, with your animal origin nature that's, you know, fundamentally a blob of protoplasm, okay? You'll be so much more self-animating, so much more spiritual, so much more innately dynamic and excited and living and, okay? And, you know, you'll see these labors for the potential and the opportunity that they are. It'll be endlessly exciting and, okay? But it's hard for us, you know, to read so much of this in here and not feel like our destiny is enslavement, you know, at times. We've talked about that. They're trying to, you know, remind us, just use your imagination as best you can. Your personality won't feel in shackles. And you won't have a self anymore that's has that tendency to see itself as in bondage. You have left that master behind long ago, remember. Only in this life do you perforce serve two masters. Yeah, right. We get rid of that quickly. So,
yep. Can you say how many there are? Like, is there somewhere? I'm just curious because when they talk about this self, you know,
You know, I can't remember if they do.
Okay.
go ahead.
The Melchizedeks function as mobile and advisory review courts of the realms. These universe sons go in small groups to the worlds to serve as advisory commissions, to take depositions, to receive suggestions, and to act as counselors, thus helping to compose the major difficulties and settle the serious differences which arise from time to time in the affairs of the evolutionary domains.
Okay, they're not helping me. Right? See how this kind of feeds in to what we were just talking about? You're going, depositions? It's like, could you have picked a more prosaic word? you know, where's the poetry I can soar on here, okay? Okay. But, you know, so try to see it as a challenge. That even the most mundane things, you know, the things that we... It's like, well, that's a legalistic word, you know. I mean, that's your first thought or something like that. Try to imagine that you'll have a mind that won't look at that and see stasis. Somehow that will be living and not mundane. And, you know, so right now at best, a lot of these things can sort of just serve as a little reminder of how immature we are, that we just can't, even our wildest stretch of imagination, put life into that thought. You know, we're just not very personal yet, is what it's trying to remind us. That it just seems so not love and so just law. You know, but to be able to get to the point where there is no difference between love and law. Remember, they're just two sides. You know, At the highest level, they're two sides of the same fact. There's no separation between them at all at the absolute level. And so the higher you go, the more they are. You know. And I point this out, but just, you know, a little thing for you to note, if you go to the dictionary, you'll make an interesting little discovery. Look up the word loyal and look up the word legal. They have the same root. They're the same word. Loyal and legal are the same word, you know, literally, etymologically. Why is it a different sequence of letters? Because one is from the unity viewpoint, and one is from the individuality viewpoint. See, that's come down from the cosmos, that truth, into our language. It's right there. We coincidentally coined a word that's the same root, you know, basically kind of the same sort of flavor of letters, okay, but slightly different. Legal is the individuality viewpoint. Loyal is the unity viewpoint, but it's the same fact. It's talking about the exact same thing. To be loyal is to be legal. To be legal is to be loyal.
These eldest sons of a universe are the chief aids of the bright and morning star in carrying out the mandates of the Creator Son. When a Melchizedek goes to a remote world in the name of Gabriel, he may, for the purposes of that particular mission, be deputized in the name of the sender, and in that event will appear on the planet of assignment with the full authority of the bright and morning star. Especially is this true on those spheres where a higher sun has not yet appeared in the likeness of the creatures of the realm.
Yeah, we all know that when there's issues with the normal order of the suns, the Melchizedeks step in. We're the poster child world for that phenomenon, right? I mean, we had Melchizedeks here before we had a planetary prince, even, you know, because we had that very special fact of having will creatures prior to the Sangiks. You know, so we had those Melchizedek observers, those 12 observers, before, you know, even before we had a planetary prince. So, yeah, we're all about this sort of special Melchizedek ministry thing when you don't have the regular sun phenomenon in play.
When a creator son enters upon the bestowal career on an evolutionary world, he goes alone. But when one of his paradise brothers, an avonal son, enters upon a bestowal, he is accompanied by the Melchizedek supporters, 12 in number, who so efficiently contribute to the success of the bestowal mission. They also support the paradise avonals on magisterial missions to the inhabited worlds, and in these assignments, the Melchizedeks are visible to mortal eyes if the avonal son is also thus manifest.
Right, see, so there you have it. And you know he's always manifest the first time. So, you know, what's in store for us? Probably in the not-too-distant future. We get our first magisterial son on a magisterial mission. He comes in, he comes incarnated on that mission. And so his 12 Melchizedeks that are accompanying him will all be, they'll all turn their internal knobs and will be manifesting physically. So we'll get 13 full-blown beings appearing, you know, in corporeal form. Okay? Well, if you try to shoot them, I think the master physical controllers might, you know, be able to deal with bullets. See, that's the thing, you know, when you start to think about, you know, some of these potential events in the future. Not all these events are going to be, you know, I mean, it's one thing for Michael to live a true man life and just let it play out as it plays out, okay? Planetary princes aren't said, well, now you can't do anything that alters the... No, you come there as the ruler of the world, you know, I mean, you do whatever. These sorts of... You know, you'll have the master physical controllers coming into play. You can drop all the hydrogen bombs on Machaventa Melchizedek's planetary headquarters you want, and the master physical controllers will just snuff them out. That's trivial stuff. They can control stars, for Pete's sake. Okay? Not even that, you know. It's just a gnat, you know. It's just nothing. Nuclear weapons are nothing compared to a volcano. okay? And a volcano is nothing compared to the sun, okay? So, you know, nuclear weapons are, you know, would be trivial. So tank shells and small arms fire is not an issue, you know, right? Those beings are, you know, anti-gravity and everything. Yeah. No, I know what you mean, but I'm just trying to throw it. I mean, we all know how poorly we treated our creator son, but just remember how different that is from these other sort of things. You know, there's no rules in play that a magisterial son has to submit himself to ignorance. So, you know, like I said, you might want not to be ignorant at that point. Right? don't be, you know, don't be found in need of subjection. okay, keep going here.
There is no phase of planetary spiritual need to which they do not minister. They are the teachers who so often win whole worlds of advanced life to the final and full recognition of the Creator Son and His Paradise Father. The Melchizedeks are well nigh perfect in wisdom, but they are not infallible in judgment. When detached and alone on planetary missions, they have sometimes erred in minor matters. That is, they have elected to do certain things which their supervisors did not subsequently approve. Such an error of judgment temporarily disqualifies a Melchizedek until he goes to Salvington and, in audience with the Creator Son, receives that instruction which effectually purges him of the disharmony which caused disagreement with his fellows, and then, following the correctional rest, reinstatement to service ensues on the third day. But these minor misadaptations in Melchizedek function have rarely occurred in Abaddon.
Okay, now there's a number of things there. Oh, and by the way, your answer is coming in the next paragraph, John. I just noticed. I forgot. It actually is right here. So this whole issue, see, the Melchizedeks are well-nigh perfect in wisdom, but remember what an error is, just merely an error, not error that results from evil, but mere error is unwise judgment. Okay, and see, that's what they're talking about here, see? But they are not infallible in judgment. They're talking about wise and unwise judgment. They can make an unwise judgment. They can make an error. Or they can, you know, give untruth form in their mind, which is an error. You go, well, wait a minute. I thought they said up here that, let's see, how did they say that? And it should be recorded that they have never abused their prerogatives, not once throughout all the super universe of Orbiton have these Melchizedek sons ever betrayed their trust.
That's different.
Okay. Remember what we're talking about up there. As a group. Okay. So again, their closeness to the mother, the individuality of the whole. And so as, you know, and they were brought together all in a very short period of time, very holistically, they are an integrous whole as a collective. Okay. But you take one of them out of that, okay. They're high enough that they don't, the evil's not a possibility, but not so high that error isn't a possibility.
Rare.
Yeah. You know, well, we're getting to that, okay. So that's the issue. They're getting, you know, they're just bringing in that unwise judgment as a possibility, and they have this whole bit of, see, getting yourself, you know, this disharmony, the universal harmony, the whole, you know, get them back synchronized with the whole in that one little area. You know, and there's even the whole, you know, 3-day thing, you know, so there's a day of rest in the middle. You know, time to reflect on that and, you know, get it fully incorporated into your being. And then that last thing that John just mentioned, see, but these minor misadaptations in Melchizedek function have rarely occurred in Abaddon. So apparently in some local universes it's not so rare. But it's interesting, so think about this. Think about the role the Melchizedeks play relative to the other sons that we were just mentioning. Michael set up this local universe So that though that normal sonship thing is going to have issues, right, at times. You know, he's loosened the constraints. So Lenon and X are going to go in random directions because they're not tightly constrained. Well, coincidentally, who fills in the gaps when Lenon and X go astray? Melchizedek. Well, if you had a local universe that had didn't have very integrous Melchizedek, that could be kind of a weak point. Coincidentally, our Melchizedeks are pretty rock solid because they're going to need to be rock solid in a loosey-goosey universe. See that, how that fits together? The supremacy of that picture?
Yeah.
That's what's going on there. Now, the one little thing, you know, we all were reminded of our the Melchizedek of record, right? Machiaventa Melchizedek. We know, the Revelator has confirmed for us, that he got overruled by the Most High Observer. You know, the Veronidek that's here overruled him that one time, at least that one time. You know, he didn't want Abraham to, you know, to go to war with all the tribes, and the Most High overruled him and said, no, I want Abraham to go out and just kill everyone. And so Abraham did. You know, and then Melchizedek said, the Most High has delivered your enemies into your hands. Right? Well, now, was that an error? Did he have to go through this process? There's no indication of that. Now think about, you know, the two things that are in play. First of all, there may have been no error on the level. If you get overruled, it may not have anything to do with there being error on the level at which you're engaged. You know, a higher level is just entered in. So that line of reasoning might suggest that there wasn't an error. He just got overruled. You know. Yes, in that sense, they're higher. They're most high. Remember?
In this instance,
right? Yeah, remember, and especially if he's assumed regency, he's very much most high. He has absolute authority. In the, you know, it says that he functions as if the absolute father was standing there. No appeal, no nothing. Okay. Not even Michael can. Like I pointed out, once you get a local universe settled in light and life, those most highs are really higher than Michael. I mean, that's why they're called the most highs. You know. So, anyway, so there's that thought that maybe there wasn't an error, but even if there was an error, it may not have been an issue like this because he was incarnated. Remember. Okay, he wasn't just the run-of-the-mill Melchizedek. I mean, mortal beings are not perfect.
Right.
Help. that very fact that, he was incarnate. So that's another line of reasoning you could bring. You could wonder, well, maybe there was an error, but it wasn't held against him like this because that's part of being incarnated. You know, that he's not going to have all of the clarity that he normally does as a full Melchizedek. I mean, he's got some of his vision is trapped, right, down in a material mind and can't see, you know, as well.
Right? Pretty close.
You guys are okay. All right.
A bestowal son who starts out with a baby, you know.
Wait, no. What now?
A bestowal son that starts out as a human baby.
Yeah.
Of course, has no wisdom.
Right.
You know. So.
Right. See, the bestowal son. Yeah. Right. See, it's all definitely there with a bestowal son, but you know, just to remember that there is that issue. I mean, he's. You know, he's incarnated. He's not pretending, you know, in any way. He's literally, he's got adjutant mind, just like we do. And, you know, and all the issues of that. So either way, yeah, I don't think he had to do this. And that's why there doesn't seem to be any indication that, you know, he had to leave the world for a while, you know, go to Salvington and then come back and join the other 11. I mean, there's no indication that that happened, right? Yeah, so... Okay, then this is the last little bit here.
these suns are not in increasing order. Their number is stationary, although varying in each local universe. The number of Melchizedeks of record on their headquarters planet in Nebadon is upward of 10 million.
Okay, so when you asked me how many are there, I had a vague memory that it was indefinite. I was remembering the first part, you know, that they vary from local universe to local universe, but I forgot that they actually do give us a count here. So somewhere above, you know, greater than 10 million.
1,111,111.
Okay, so saith the Steve. So there's, you know, I mean, again, that's not a huge number. At least it's bigger than 1,000. At least it's kind of a 1-to-1 for the 10 million inhabited worlds. But you know, they're obviously going to be quite busy. You know, that's the one little thing to, you know, to kind of take from that number. Even though, you know, it's bigger than a 1,000, it's still only 10 million. Put yourself in the bigger context. These guys are going nonstop, obviously. I mean, they're, you know, it's a good thing they don't have to sleep.
Because there's a bunch of them here.
Right. Well, not anymore. But that whole issue of, you know, when we had them here, we had 12. Okay. Or if they're with a magisterial mission, there's 12 of them. So, I mean, you know, you're going to burn through 10 million pretty fast like that. They're obviously very, very, very busy beings. So that fact that they got to be they're very busy and they have to be around a lot, it does bring in this issue of traveling at 3 times the speed of light. There's going to be some. They're going to have to be managed. There's going to be a lot of logistics to that. You've got to make sure that you don't get caught off guard. You're in charge of things. You know, you need to send 12 Melchizedeks back to the planet because Adam and Eve, you know, dropped the ball. You know, you can't have, you know, oh, we don't have any available locally. It's going to be 1,000 years before, you know. I mean, they got to get there and right away. So see, there's going to be all kinds of logistics of managing where these guys are stationed. And, you know, when they know that things are getting a little dicey, you know, they're going to post some more reserves in that area. And they would have to manage it like that. All right, so we'll continue on next time here with the Melchizedek worlds. Let's just take a moment here.